order to keep growth alive, and as soon as the core surf shop kid saw the brands he loved in department stores and at the mall, as soon as he saw the kooks in school wearing what defined him, he left it behind. Everything is cyclical in fashion, and obviously cuts come and go and come. Colors come and go and come. Trends come and go and come. Peg pants come and go and come. Surf came and went. But it's a difficult thing for true surfers to understand because why would anyone ever leave surf? True surfers, including those that staff the surf industry, are caught off guard by each recession because surf is the only thing in the world that makes sense to them. And when the public writ large catches on for brief moments, they agitate at the potential crowds in the water, but also, quietly, feel that they are the secret kings of the entire world, the envy of civilization. But when it goes out, surfers are never prepared, or at least those who make their money in surf. The professional surfing tour, dreamt up by Fred Hemmings and executed more properly by Ian Cairns, had expanded to 1,000 shitty little beach breaks with professionals mastering the art of 3 turns to the beach. The ugliest sort of anything, where the most talented of surfers grovel for points, bumping and jiving, bouncing and hopping in waves that even the most desperate kids frown upon. It's an entirely unattractive dance, even to the most diehard surf fan, and turned off any potential newcomers. Furthermore, by 1990, surfing was officially old. 3 full generations had sucked the marrow. Grandparents were riding the longboards Michael Thompson detested. Lawyer dads were out shredding Dawn Patrol. Doctor moms were wearing Quicksilver's New Roxy and catching the evening glass off with their girlfriends. Surfing, for maybe the first time in history, was totally and completely lame. A giant turkey trot. It wasn't all bad, of course. Kelly Slater turned pro in 1990. The bronzed half-Syrian wunderkind from Cocoa Beach, Florida, may be the greatest figurehead any sport, industry, or activity has ever had. A smidge better than Muhammad Ali. 100 times better than Lance Armstrong. He has miraculously remained beyond handsome and beyond talented for almost 50 years, winning 11 world titles and co-starring on Baywatch. He has also dated Leonardo DiCaprio's girlfriend, Bar Raffaele, Tom Brady's wife, Gisele Bündchen, Justin Timberlake's ex, Cameron Diaz, and Pamela Anderson. How is that? The year 1990 was also the year Tom Carroll entered the Australian Surfing Hall of Fame. The short, powerful man from Sydney dominated the tours in the 1980s and always seemed a clean-cut poster child for hard work and good living. He even wore a helmet when surfing Pipeline, the best example possible for young, impressionable kids. In the 2000s, he helped push big wave surfing to new heights by towing into never-before-witnessed monsters, a thing that over-the-hill surfers do even today. I was never too much a fan, since he's short and powerful, and also since he surfed big waves. But after his competitive days were over, his brother Nick, the most famous surf journalist of all, wrote a biography detailing how much cocaine Tom had stuffed up his nose. And it made me like him lots more. Still, outside of Kelly and outside of Tom's addiction, things were grim. The 1980s and the yuppies and the fun had taken a real toll. Stockbrokers were going to see psychiatrists, complaining about strange visions and uncontrollable paranoia. Not quite as fantastic as David Bowie's semen-stealing demons, perhaps, but still enough to drive them to seek help. The first batch of help seekers was turned away, because cocaine still wasn't seen as addictive in those early years. But then John Belushi died of an overdose. Richard Pryor set himself on fire freebasing it. Crack got invented. And Ronald Reagan decided that better than the wars in Afghanistan and South America was to ramp up America's war on drugs by enforcing mandatory minimum sentencing and locking kids up for decades. Crack was more heavily punished than cocaine because it was an inner-city drug, not a trading floor surf one. But in broad culture, the sheen had worn off. Cocaine shifted away from being Dom Perignon to being the thing responsible for crack babies, riots, murders, and celebrity death. Like surfing, it was out of style, stuck in the quicksand of changing taste. It was out, hammered, done. Except, in a surf culture that was circling the drain of relevancy, just like it is today. And I'm stuck in the quicksand of my own moral quagmire, which my computer is mocking with its hypocritical cursor. On, off, on, off. Not being one nor the other. Being false. Blink. 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 With blank spaces on either side. Blank spaces. Nothing. Nothing but, "Help! Surf icon vows rage!" I can't even muster the strength to be a gutter writer anymore. Knowing that I'm an upside-down hypocrite has finally killed me all the way, or at least killed what's left of my completely compromised aspirations. The sun is shining and the birds are chirping. I log on to Surfline just to get away from the cursor and to see what's happening in the water, even though it means that damned Marcus Sanders gets my click. It's calling 3 to 5 foot, occasionally 6, primary peaking west-northwest swell blends with some smaller south-southwest swell this morning. Many spots throughout the region offer broken up and fairly peaky waist-to-shoulder-high surf with occasional head-high sets. Basically gibberish. Surfline only speaks nonsense, so much nonsense that some amazing woman just tattooed "Fuck Surfline" on her heel. Can you imagine the frustration that it would take to do that? Fuck Surfline. But from the accompanying webcam, I can see it's good, or at least fun, and fuck it. Fuck it all. I push away from my desk and the cursor and the molasses surrounding my life, go to the garage, grab my board, throw it in my Volkswagen Jetta wagon, and coast down the hill to the beach. It's a brilliant day. The sun glistening in a cornflower sky. The smallest touch of warm wind tickling the palms, but not rippling the water. The smell of carne asada and s'mores floating. Good-sized set waves stacking out the back, mowing over a couple on matching foam Costco wave storms. They are paddling furiously and appear to be shouting encouragement to one another as the militant whitewash steams in, then swamps them. Their Costco wave storms shooting into the air, tangling and dragging owners. Otherwise, it's not too crowded, and I hop down the stairs two at a time, happy to leave the world, my purpose, my stalled journey behind. Happy to vacate my last few drips of sense. It's what all surfers do, I suppose. Surfing becomes an unconscious tick like Tourette's. And so, when the mind stops functioning properly, the surfer automatically just goes surfing. It's another reason that Hollywood has never figured out how to make a proper surf film. The directors and producers and actors who don't have pterygium actually push through creative blocks and get things done instead of fleeing into the ocean and pretending to dance. There's no such thing as a successful surfer outside the professional tour or the industry. President Obama? He didn't surf. He swam in the ocean. Eddie Vedder? Nope, he rides egg-shaped things. Matthew McConaughey? Yeah, he's not a real surfer. Chris Hemsworth? He might become a proper actor and win all the Academy Awards on offer if he just stopped fucking surfing. Scott Kahn? 3 words. Hawaii 5-0. And I plunge into the cool Pacific, feeling the sun on my shoulders, the salt water in my hair, and don't care about any of it, wondering if this is how Jonah felt when he jumped overboard. I paddle to the lineup easily enough, duck diving a good set wave and watching the white clouds of aerated water boil and churn over my head. A good duck dive feels almost as good as a proper wave, gliding beneath the ferocity of the ocean. It feels good, right. And I sit on my board, alternately squirting water through my hands and shielding my eyes, looking out toward the horizon, listening to the surfers around me talk about upcoming trips to Indonesia and Mexico, about waves they just came back from in Costa Rica and New Zealand. It really is a wonder that surfers, as shallow and empty as we are, travel so wide and far for waves. I think of all the places I've been for waves and think that the act of surfing in and of itself is velocity. And like that, a wave comes. I'm not in the right place, but think about dropping in anyway because I'm frustrated and surf-starved. But better judgment carries the day, and I watch a tanned youth shimmy off the bottom and rocket down the line right underneath my nose. He's the very picture of cool, of surf perfection, and he moves. Another wave comes, and this time I do drop in, because I see the unfortunate man wearing earplugs and riding an ugly 7-foot epoxy thing from Thailand that's not going to make it. I keep my eyes on him, watch his knee pummel the deck off his board, watch his hand slip off the rail, watch him bury in the wave, becoming one with it, and he moves. I pop up and imagine that I look like a graceful pelican as I glide up and down before cutting back and rebounding off the whitewash. Moving. I'm happy earplugs fell and might have internally mocked his inability, but no better, because even though I imagine I look like a graceful pelican, in reality, I'm somewhere between a limping gazelle and an injured drop bear. I have seen the proof. It happened during a fine enough day just recently, and I was out shredding, killing it. Radical turns off the top. Committed bottom turns with a totally engaged rail. I caught one last one, whacked it off the lip, and then rode the whitewash in, feeling like Mikhail Baryshnikov. Like Alexander fucking Petrovsky. A woman was standing on the cliff, near the path toward the street, with the camera. And she smiled at me as I approached on my way up. "I got some shots of you today," she said with coy eyes. "Yeah," I responded, and she handed me a business card that said, "You were shredding. I got the proof," with a web address where her pictures could be purchased. I gave her a cool guy thanks, while maybe tossing a very lazy shaka, took the card, and went about my day. That night, though, after a few vodka drinks, I got curious and logged on to her site, scrolled through the day's pictures, and found three of me. My radical turns off the top looked like a giraffe on ice skates. My committed bottom turns looked like a 3-year-old trying to sink a toy boat in the bathtub. My whack off the lip was not actually off the lip, but midway through a wave that was no bigger than knee-high. It was embarrassing. It's always embarrassing for anyone but pros or ex-pros to see themselves surf. The chasm between what we imagine and what we are is vast, but instantly bridged with photo or video evidence in a deeply troubling way. What we imagine is poetic, and what we are is fucked. But both cases are movement, both are velocity, and as I paddle back out to the lineup, I feel as though I'm coming unstuck, that I'm starting to break through. And this is also the problem with surfing as Tourette's, with surfing becoming an unconscious tick. The stuck surfer always feels like he reaches some sort of breakthrough when he gets out in the water. I know it's impossible, but I would love to see the actual quality of ideas had while surfing. I bet they're almost as good as the ideas had while high on weed. A little worse than the problems solved with cocaine. But still, I'm feeling it. My mind is racing again. Clarity beginning to rise from the grave where my completely compromised aspirations had just been buried. A renewed sense of purpose starting to pulse through my veins as I feel the waves start to dissipate in my body. And I watch as Earplugs paddles while lying too far back on his board. And the tanned youth attempting air reverse after air reverse, and the cool kids and the rad dad and the world travelers. When I first started doing surf journalism, splashing in the shallow end, contextualizing the nothing, writing for the audience I'm amongst right now, I made a name for myself by being the most decadent surf journalist around, for only writing about sex, sex, drugs, drugs, and maybe, if there was no more sex or drugs, then writing about surfing. I wasn't very popular. Letters to the editor, comment boards, social media posts would all decry my particular brand of what my best Australian pal and biz partner deemed trash prose, but I didn't give two shits. That was the surf world as I saw it. Cocaine and meaningless sex. Those were the two things everyone appreciated equally. And if everyone is going to live that way, then they should embrace it. What's the point of racking rails and mindlessly rooting chicks if you're going to pretend you aren't? Martin Luther, one of the greatest Christians of all time, wrote, "Be a sinner and sin boldly, but believe and rejoice in Christ more boldly still." In my mind, the two are the same, and all I wanted the surf industry, the surfers, the hangers-on, to do was to be bold and sin boldly. To not hide anymore, to exit the closet into the full warm light of grace, to set out on the path that will end with them believing and rejoicing in Christ more boldly still, right? I was allowed to edit an issue of a surf magazine one time in my life, Australia's Stab, the fake version of Beach Grit. And I agreed, as long as I could put an Australian star surfer on the cover with his whole head buried in a second-place trophy filled with cocaine. The owner, a striking blonde man who wore purple Gucci high tops, hemmed and hawed, trying to get me off the idea in a multitude of ways before finally saying no. So I agreed to edit the issue if I could sublimate a swastika over a picture of a man riding a gorgeous wave while the sun set on the cover instead. He let me. And how crazy is that? How fucking crazy is that? Cocaine-addled surfers are more afraid of cocaine depictions than they are of being likened to Nazi Germany. Wild. The cover bit that owner on his ass when Australian surf hero Mick Fanning called me a fucking Jew at his world title party. I wrote a story detailing the funny exchange, but Mick didn't think it was funny and went crying to the press, insisting I was the anti-Semite because I stuck swastikas on magazine covers. Every one of those back issues quickly disappeared. But oh, that was a fun dance. And fuck Mick Fanning to this day. He deserves to get eaten by a shark, which he almost did in South Africa, but whatever. Sin and sin boldly. That's what I want all surfers to do. That's what Michael Thompson did, and I'm not an upside-down hypocrite for appreciating him, for thinking he's the pinnacle of our surf world. I can't walk his path, but I can still carry his story, and it will free earplugs and the tanned youth and the cool kids and the rad dads, even the damn skin-tight polo dads, from their lame bondage. What's more, I can just tell the truth. Why fucking not? It's the apocalypse. Who's gonna bust me? I take the next wave in and run across the sand, back up the steps, two at a time, excited to get back to my computer, excited to move this love story along. I fish my car keys out of some nearby bushes, pop the back, throw my board in, and skip to the driver's door, checking my phone just to make sure my cute little button of a daughter didn't call someone an asshole at school again. But there's another text message from an unknown Orange County number. "Hey, Chad, got your number from Matt. If you're really doing a story on what I think you're doing a story on, then we need to talk." I read it twice. Fucking Chad. Chaz always gets spell check corrected into Chad, and it drives me crazy. I really, really don't like the name Chad. But I guess it's my punishment for going by Chaz publicly. My penance for actively pushing a totally douche nickname. Chaz. Have you ever met a Chaz who wasn't a douche? Exactly. But the meat of the text, who's it from and what does he have to tell me? Part of me is very curious. Part of me dreads. After cocaine and meaningless sex, Surfers love telling stories most of all. Surf historian Matt Warshaw wrote that he couldn't wait to sledge away at the cheerleading and boosterism and perjured nobility layered onto most of the surf history. Pulling down shoddy historiographic handicraft is, by itself, I admit, pretty satisfying. Oh, Lord, I can't even imagine the stories he had to sit through while writing his masterpiece. Surfers will drop names, and then more names, and then more and more and more names. Like, there was this one time where Dougie Freeburn and Finless Frankie were out at North Point, and Jock paddled out on his 9-0, and Dougie said, "What the hell is that?" But Jock thought he said, "Could I smell your hat?" And that's where the term evening glass came from. Or, Disco Dave was ripping out at Swami's and watched a dolphin jump out of the water, and this was in 1974, so he wanted to try it too, and this is where surf wax came from. Or, never mind, I'll spare you. It's one of the more difficult parts of surf journalism, if any of it can actually be described as difficult. Figuring out how to cut every story but a few. Shredding characters and episodes and stories that all mean something and point to something. But fucking hell, it's easy to lose the main track and end up in some weird narrative backwater, holding Finless Frankie's hand in weeds so tall they block out the sun. And I'm hoping, beyond fucking hope, that these are not the weeds when I text back, "Sure, where you want to meet?" I had just regained velocity, even if it was only an illusion. I was about to move again, but now I guess I'm moving too. And my phone buzzes a text response. "San Juan Capistrano? There's that little bistro by the train tracks." I'm moving to Orange County. Back to cocaine's adopted home. Son of a bitch. But was there ever really another way? Chapter 13. The Magic Flight. A train blows its whistle as it comes into the station, startling me from a story about where the swallows went. They were what once made San Juan Capistrano famous, flying up from Argentina on March 19th of each and every year and nesting in the town's famous mission. Pat Boone sang about them. So did Elvis Presley. "When the swallows come back to Capistrano," they crooned, "that's the day you promised to come back to me. When you whispered farewell in Capistrano, 'twas the day the swallow flew out to sea." Ha! Schlocky bullshit. But guess who hasn't come back to Capistrano since 2009? Pat Boone. He's too busy being old and accusing Obama of being a Muslim. Elvis. He's too busy being dead. And the swallows. They're too busy building nests in the dung of Chino Hills instead of San Juan. An inland city famous for cows and Steve McQueen attending its high school for troubled boys. And so San Juan Capistrano is now famous for nothing but memories of fabulous times past. And no one knows why the sparrows left, I was reading before the train blew its whistle. Some think that it's because of a building tossed up taller than the mission in 2009, and it threw the birds off their migratory game. Some think the birds really never actually returned en masse to Capistrano, that it was only folklore pushed out by Pat Boone and Elvis Presley. Others think that the California urban sprawl disoriented the birds. Or at least, those are the three theories kicked out by the Los Angeles Times in its 2009 story. It almost reads like a beach grit story, and I'm about to make a mental note to employ it as a story intro when I hear a jazz and look up and see Jeffrey Lebowski. Not the rich one in the wheelchair, but the dude. The Jeff Bridges one. The dude in gait. The dude in movement. The dude in dress. The dude in everything but the white Russian. And as I wonder what stories of 1970s cocaine smuggling he's gonna get me in the weeds over, my heart sinks. Fuck, the damned weeds. Even worse if he thinks this love story is actually about weed. Oh, please, no. Please, 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 no. Weed stories are the absolute worst. The dude reaches out his hand and says, I'm Jim Zapala. Nice to meet you, man. And he totally sounds like the dude, too. Like he fell out of the movie and into San Juan Capistrano. Nice to meet you, too, I respond with a sinking pit in my stomach. The velocity I just grabbed by the tail, even if it is totally illusionary, will definitely be undone if Jim gets into weed stories. Fuck. We can grab a drink or something to eat right over here, man, he says, pointing to a woodsy outdoor patio attached to a cute bistro. Bistro. I never eat at bistros, and I think it's a subconscious tic stemming from my Coos Bay roots. There was a bistro down near the tugboat dock, and my dad told me it was owned by an atheist who didn't support Coos Bay schools because he voted no on some school funding measure and they served beer and wine. That was three strikes right there, and I suppose my heart still retains a beat of revulsion against the bistro. These dens of unmitigated sin. These degraded hovels that don't support public education. But this one is cute, and maybe I should rethink the bistro program. We sit at a high outdoor table. I order a vodka soda. Jim orders a shrimp ceviche that he pronounces ceviche. I'll take the ceviche, man. And then he looks at me and says, are you really doing a story on surfing and drugs? I look him up and down and say, no, not drugs. Cocaine. Only cocaine. He leans back like the dude, eyes smiling, mouth pulling into a broad grin, and starts vigorously shaking his head up and down in agreement, like he's been waiting for this moment his whole life. Waiting for someone to see that all the weed and LSD and heroin and pills and whatever are all cheap and meaningless nothings. That surfing and cocaine are the only true lovers. A story that transcends. And he says, that is the drug. That's it. It is cocaine. As much as it was then, it is today. And I've done so much, and so has everyone else. Throughout those years, there's not one president. Well, there were a few exceptions like Bob Hurley and, I don't know, a few others. But man, it was everywhere. And it's still around today as much as it was then. Cocaine. It's cocaine. My drink arrives. I take a long sip, keeping Jim in my gaze, and all of a sudden I get the overwhelming feeling that this meeting was written in the stars, ordained by God. Maybe. I ask him, so what's your hook in this damned little surf industry of ours? He leans forward and says, MT, man. In the normal course of my surf journalism duties, I usually relegate the chore of corroborating stories to the pile of things that will not get done that day, mixed right in with smogging the car and putting the bedroom curtains up. There's rarely a point in my mind. Surfing, surf personalities, and surf stories are about a sensation. Whether any of it's true or not is immaterial and doesn't change the way it feels. Except truth matters in love. Truth and honesty may even matter more than anything else. True love cannot exist, much less grow, where falsehoods flourish, where lies or omissions strangle. God knew that I would take Michael Thompson's stories, his value, his importance at face value, so he brought me an angel dressed like the dude. Maybe. You worked for Gotcha, I ask? Yeah, man, so this would have been in 1988 or 89. That's when I started doing work for them, and they were the kings. They were doing probably $125 million a year, which for that time was unheard of. Being from Newport, all my friends worked at Quicksilver, but Gotcha was in its heyday at that moment. So I went and met MT. He gave me a t-shirt to do a graphic on, so I did it for him, and I brought it to him, and, you know, he was the guy, so I brought it, and he said, okay, you want a job? And so here I am, 28 years old. He offered me a job as a clothing designer, and I didn't have any training or anything, and I said, well, shit. Gotcha was the coolest thing in the world back then, and at that time it was huge. I think The M&D department had like 45 people. It was giant, and I was just so in awe. I literally didn't speak in that building for 2 years because I was so... I wanted to learn everything. Everyone was great, and it was such a good time. His ceviche comes, and he deftly snags a shrimp with a chip. It's almost hard to imagine the surf industry being the coolest thing in the world, huge and vibrant. The predominant sensation when walking into the headquarters of Quicksilver, Billabong, Rip Curl, Reef, Volcom, Hurley, etc., today, is sadness. It's desperation, which is quickly chased by lots of marketing speak. How was working for Michael, I ask. I'd heard a few different stories before, and most weren't the best. Jim snags another shrimp and says, "You know, I've worked for a lot of guys, and Michael was..." And he pauses, looking over my shoulder, searching for words. "You could call him any time of the night and say, 'I've got an idea for this or that,' and he was the most supportive ever. He'd always be up for it. He'd be like, 'Do it, let's do it.' Most inspirational guy I've ever seen. He just completely loved and had a passion for creativity and wanted to do whatever. If it felt good, let's fucking do it." Again, I'm struck by the dissonance bouncing off today's surf industry, where, aside from inventing anti-shark technology that gets kids' arms bitten off, genius is in short supply, and creativity in even shorter. "Not only was he the most inspirational person to be around," Jim continues, "but what I really saw in him was his ability to see stuff way down the road, and that blew me away. I can't think what I'm going to do in the next 2 hours. He has such perception of what's going to happen." And this seamless corroboration with how Michael perceives his own particular abilities makes me wonder, how often do our perceptions about what makes us great, or at least unique, line up with what others think makes us unique, or at least tolerable? I've always cherished my ability to link two seemingly disparate concepts together, demonstrating the undeniable connection between things that should never touch. I latched on to the dreamy idea of California and its embodiment in surfing when I was a boy, and mashed the two together in Oregon. I accidentally studied for a semester at Oxford University's Keble College when I was an undergraduate in a Renaissance and Medieval Studies program. We were supposed to read and expound on a menage of Shakespeare in the 1590s and Constantine's visions of warfare and Plato's influence on Machiavelli. All fine and good, but I discovered Albert Camus in Oxford and couldn't get enough. When I was supposed to be reading The Mystics, I was reading The Plague and The Stranger and The Myth of Sisyphus underneath those soaring spires. When the semester ended, we were supposed to write some massive thesis, and I wrote about how Camus was a modern version of St. Bonaventure. I was the only student in the entire program to get a D. But I didn't care, because I then started traveling to the Middle East, feeling in my heart of hearts that radical Islam was the new punk rock. All those early stories pushed this narrative, that radical Islam was nothing to fear, that it was the only young and viable alternative discourse alive in a world overcome by knee-jerk capitalism. Hezbollah might have given me a D too, but I didn't care because I was surfing again, watching cocaine disappear up noses, and just beginning to feel the pangs of the world's greatest love story. Does anyone else appreciate this in me? I will tell you now, no. My links seem arbitrary and fall apart under the withering stares of high school girlfriends, scholars, and jihadis. Except this last one, between cocaine and surfing, will not fall apart, because the surf industry has no withering stare, and more importantly, because it's true. But cocaine. I almost forgot about cocaine and asked Jim, "But what about cocaine? What about Michael and his legendary cocaine?" Jim rubs his chin and says, "Man, nobody was ever like Michael. When I first started going there, he was beginning to become distant from the company. He would show up at 11:45, and he would leave at 1:45, and nobody would see him. He had a private entrance. And Joel, his partner, we didn't talk to him. Joel was the cheesiest guy in the world. Michael was the pro surfer, good-looking guy. Joel didn't surf, wore parachute pants and silk Gucci shirts unbuttoned and medallions. And fuck, so the company was split in half. You had marketing and design, which was Michael's. Joel was sales and production. So it was like two completely different companies. Like we were fucking cool, and they were cheeseballs. I never even talked to Joel. He was just so ew. So Michael was becoming. Now here's a good story for you. We threw this party once, and Michael wasn't there, but this was the ethos of the time, right? Blow and craziness, and like the best time ever. So the good thing was, I had a real job, and for the first time I thought, fuck, I could do this. Not that I was worried, I was having the time of my life, but all of a sudden, at that time, I mean, it was at the height. All of a sudden, I'm flying first class on Virgin to London and Paris, and told, buy whatever the fuck you want, and staying at the best hotels, and it was just insane. But one of the things I'll remember at that very first sales meeting I went into, it was at the Phoenician Resort in Arizona. So we had this sales meeting, and we fly there, check in, and I remember the lobby was giant, and all these tourists were there, fat people from Minneapolis, and they were all wearing Gotcha. I thought, this company's even more popular than I ever imagined. Even tourists were wearing Gotcha. Everybody in the lobby, neon orange and lime and Gotcha everywhere. I thought, shit, this is the biggest company in the world. The next day we go into this huge ballroom, and all those people I thought were tourists wearing Gotcha were the sales force. And there were hundreds of them. That's when I figured out that was the demise. Michael was becoming more and more reclusive, and Joel couldn't say no to a deal. All these sleazeballs were selling it, and that was the end. I didn't know it, though, and neither did anyone else, because when you're going up, you don't think about going down. And Gotcha was one of the first to go that way. But I've seen companies make the exact same mistakes for the last 30 years. Let's get a new building. Let's acquire. Acting like the party is never going to end. It just got sleazier and sleazier. And that's why we started More Core Division in 1990, or maybe 1991, because Michael wanted to have his identity back. Good business. He didn't start MCD because Gotcha was going south. He just wanted to get back to his core customer. The specialty stores turned on Gotcha. Nobody liked Joel, and he became the face of the company. Michael became more reclusive. You know, the surf industry guys who succeeded in those years knew it was important to sustain those relationships, but Michael was just getting more and more into his weird world. He started not wanting to be around Gotcha, to be around those people. The product was changing. We had a kind of recession there that really hit the wall in 1991. A lot of stuff started changing rapidly. Yeah, sure, but the cocaine. What about the cocaine? Jim laughs. I've been through a lot with Michael. I mean, so much. We used to fly back in the day. One time we went to Tavarua with a bunch of guys, and this is where Michael was. There's no coke on Tavarua. So we fly to Hawaii, and then fly to Fiji, then boat to Tavarua, and cloud break was 4 to 6 foot the first 3 days. Just perfect. Just beautiful. The fourth day we wake up, and Michael had to leave. He couldn't stay. He had to fly back to Hawaii because he couldn't be without his coke. It was as good as you'd want it to be in Tavarua, and he had to leave. The guy was just a freak coke addict, you know? He shouldn't be walking. I drain my drink and order another while the dude gets back into full rhythm. In the 90s, when we were traveling, when he was going to London or Paris, he would FedEx himself in a magazine a baggie of coke. And he would send it before we left, and we'd be checking every day when we got back to the hotel from shopping. Half the time it wouldn't come, but half the time it would, and that was before 9/11 and all that. But we'd have great times in Paris when it didn't show up. This one night we were in Paris. We had this guy who repped it in Europe and went out to this wild club. Michael left like he always did. I stayed, took a cab back to the hotel, and there were these two chicks out there asking if I wanted a massage. I'm going, no, no, no. They were kind of ugh. but I noticed they had a shopping bag that was from one of the stores me and Michael had bought stuff from that day. And she's holding this bag, and I'm thinking, that's weird. We bought stuff from that store. I didn't think nothing of it. Went to bed. Saw Michael the next morning, and he said, you wouldn't believe what happened to me last night. Two chicks asked if I wanted a massage. I said, yeah, come up to the room. They came up to the room. The chicks are massaging him. He falls asleep, and the chicks rip him off. He's running down the hall naked after them. And Jim breaks into a wide laugh. Stuff like that happened all the time. He goes on and on in the most candid manner, telling story after story of gotcha mayhem, of Michael leading the charge. He tells the same story that Michael told about the hooker with the wig, except in Jim's version it got ripped off in the bathroom. But still, the entire surf industry hierarchy, except Michael, was stuffed in there, standing around the sinks and between the partitions. He tells stories of the darker side, employees that fell over the edge. Man, we were amateurs at it when it came to partying when all this started. But we went gnarly, or a lot of us did. He tells stories leading up to the present moment and Michael's legal trouble. Michael was in very big denial when he started having legal problems. It's not my coke, and all that, and fuck that. Come on, Michael. But any one of the presidents of any of the companies, all of them were the same way. Michael just went bigger. And he tells the stories with neither axe to grind nor conspiratorial attempt to tarnish anyone's reputation. He tells them without any particular relish, without looking for any kind of rubberneck credit for exposing what would normally be considered unseemly bits. He loves Michael still, and mostly tells the stories simply because they're true, but also to highlight Michael's generosity. I think I know Michael more than anyone, and through everything, through my divorce. My wife had gambled away all my money. I find out she's got credit cards I didn't know about. Michael called me and said, hey, you're coming to Hawaii. Bought you a ticket. Come stay with me in Hawaii. People don't realize how generous he is. I know all those guys. There's nobody like him. His generosity is for all his other stuff, and that's the thing. Everybody turned on him, but he was giving everybody coke. Everybody was partying on his dime. All those same people who are bad-mouthing him now or don't want to be around him now, they were right there with him, trust me. I was right there with him, too. He sits back and stares at his half-eaten ceviche for a moment, lost in thought, struggling under the weight of a clear and particular sadness. He's a very generous soul, man. He's got something. I know, I've seen him. He gave one surf industry executive $80K to get a house when that guy first moved here to give him a start. He never paid him back. The guy has literally given away everything for his drug demons, and they're there. He pauses again. I always knew the ride that he was on was not going to end well. He wasn't going to have any friends left because he was so powerful. The girls loved him. Everybody loved the blow. They loved his power. I just knew you can't live this way, and he's going to end up with nothing and nobody. Fuck. The surf industry. Such a piece of shit. It's got to be torn down and built from the bottom up. It's full of a bunch of shitheads, and it's gotten more and more like that over the years. Bunch of fucking... He pauses for the last time. It'll never be like Michael Thompson again. And with that, he pushes his chair back and wanders back from whence he came, into an Orange County late afternoon. The rapidly disappearing sun bathing everything in the most golden light imaginable. I sit by myself for a long time, listening to the birds that aren't swallows chirping, watching the trains slow as they come into the station, disgorging business commuters, kids, and parents, seeing a man in a teal Visla t-shirt have a very animated conversation with a man in a Billabong t-shirt celebrating Billabong team rider Joel Parkinson's 2012 world title. It screams, Parco, in bold yellow font. And I wonder what they're discussing so passionately. Paul Nowdy, the man who held the United States Billabong license forever, had jumped ship a few years ago to start Visla. Could they be arguing about surf industry ethics? About right and wrong? Chapter 14. Rescue from Without. I spend the next few days wrestling with the meaning of cocaine and surfing in a deeper way, or at least deeper for me, or at least more seriously, not thinking about it in some grand arcing narrative, not thinking about it as the oldest love story on earth or a great uniter of disparate communities in our completely fractured modern times, not thinking of myself as surf journalist or narc or prophet or gutter writer or failure, not thinking of myself at all, in fact, but thinking about generosity and honesty and how much I miss both. What the fuck happened? Where'd they go? Why did they go? My head is so clouded that I almost accidentally lose my daughter in Legoland's Adventure Club somewhere between the ancient Egypt scene and the Ice Age one. I almost accidentally post a story on Beach Grit about how easily agitated surf photographers get, which would have fucked the website literally forever. Hell hath no fury like a surf photographer scorned, or so the old adage goes. And now I'm at yet another surf film premiere, this one for a big wave surfer who's nice enough, but I can't be bothered with his general aesthetic, and can't be bothered with the empty surf chatter, and can't be bothered with the clenched jaws and undrunk drinks, because there's no love story on earth that is not generous and honest. And fuck, where'd they go? Why did generosity and honesty go? This particular big wave surf film is sponsored by Austria's number one export, Red Bull, which has tried to capture the extreme sport market since its inception with varying degrees of success, and it is a classic of its genre. Expensive, super high definition, lots of very slow slow-mo, some attempt at introspection, generally unpopular. But Red Bull knows how to throw a party, and I am forever indebted. I met my wife while directing a Red Bull surf film at the premiere of a different Red Bull surf film. And what are the odds of that? In extreme sport, they're actually pretty good. I was living in Australia at the time, and happy having just left the ex-wife, feeling free. The sun was bright, if cancerous, the meat pies were delicious, and I had a wonderful girlfriend in Melbourne. Then, out of the blue, professional Hawaiian surfer Jamie O'Brien called me and asked me if I could come back to the States to direct his Red Bull film. He had all the footage, he just needed someone to put it together and tell a story. I told him yes on one condition, that I could go back to Australia in 3 weeks. He agreed, and I flew to Los Angeles. The second night I was back, professional surfer Julian Wilson premiered his Red Bull film in Santa Ana, and I went to the premiere so I could gauge the state of the union. It was a fine film, but nothing overwhelming, and I thought, oh yeah, 3 weeks, I've got this. After it was done, I milled under the Orange County stars with the rest of the surf industry, feeling happy and good, and then the only surf film director worth anything, a true auteur who had left Ridley Scott behind so that he could shoot surfers on film, a man named Joe G, came over to me, pointed to a gorgeous blonde across the patio, and said, "You and she are going to do amazing things together." He went, grabbed her by the arm, and within 2 months I was a bigamist with an Australian girlfriend, all thanks to Red Bull. The energy drink giant was first introduced into the American market, via California, of course, in 1997, right when the surf industry was ready to slough off its latest recession, right when the world was beginning to gag for surf culture once again. The stale 1990s, the demise of Gotcha and Op and the surf look, took a heavy toll, but the cancerous sun always shines again. Kelly Slater with his girlfriends and his Baywatch kept getting more and more dreamy. Not only was he winning every surf contest, rising up the ranks and winning world titles, he was on the cover of Andy Warhol's Interview magazine under the brilliant headline, "Half Fish, Total Dish," and he was the best thing to happen to surfing since Peruvians and cocaine. But he wasn't the only sexy thing happening. Lisa Anderson, my favorite surfer ever, was winning her own titles, and so sexy, so cute, so stylish, so good on a surfboard that Quicksilver invented the whole line for her. Roxy took the world by storm. Every girl wanted to be a Roxy girl, and every girl wanted to own a pair of Roxy board shorts. All of a sudden, they could have something in the surf world that wasn't purely demeaning, that was forward-looking, fun, and proudly feminine. Lisa Anderson was a better representation of the surf ideal than had ever existed before, even better than Kelly Slater. She was tan, fit, wildly talented, and delightfully sexy. She was surf, and a mini-revolution followed in her caramel wake. Even better, the film Blue Crush came out, which featured girl surfers conquering Oahu's North Shore. It was inspirational, even though it was made, written, and directed by Hollywood folk who don't even know what pterygia are, much less have them. Even though the waves were actually ridden by stuntmen in drag. The film displayed a world of sexy surf that had been sorely missing and made a cool $52 million at the box office. Brian Grazer produced it, and I think maybe he's a surfer, like Rips Malibu in Hawaii. I lunched with him once in his Hollywood office, and he asked me if the G-Unit box of clothes that just came in was cool. Even better, though, and Michael Thompson told me this story, one time he and Eddie Rothman were apparently shopping at Foodland on the North Shore, filling up their cart with booze and meat. When it was time to check out, Eddie patted his back pocket and said, "Brah, I forgot my wallet." Michael patted his back pocket and said, "Brah, I forgot mine too." Eddie scanned the people in line and said, "No problem. See that guy with the hair all sticking up? He wants to do my life story. We'll make him pay for it." It was Brian Grazer, and as the story goes, he whipped out his wallet faster than you can say false crack and eagerly bought Eddie Rothman and Michael Thompson all of their groceries. Eddie laughed as the two left and said, "He ain't never gonna do my life story." Very funny. And while Brian Grazer may never get to make "Ho, brother," an Eddie Rothman life, his Blue Crush was genuinely okay. The girls had cracked a new market, and Laird Hamilton, on the other end of the sexuality spectrum, had just come into his own. The adopted son of Bill Hamilton, 1970s surf-style master, was so much man he'd make Hercules weep with envy. 6'3" and cut from marble, with a neck as thick as a redwood and a jaw like a bulldozer. He decided that the tiny little beach break waves on that day's professional tour were not conducive to his girth, so he struck out on his own to conquer the biggest monsters the ocean could serve up. In an odd turn, he too jumped into weird surf Hollywood, starring as the bad guy in the surf schlock classic North Shore, with neon paint swirling around his nipples. His poor acting did little to damage his big wave skill, though, and it was Laird's ride at a newly hyped Tahitian spot named Te Ahupo'o that kicked both him and surfing to the next level. Te Ahupo'o translates to English as "to sever the head" or "place of crushed skulls," and a better description could not be painted. It's a scary wave, coming out of the deep and breaking on a shallow shelf. It's like the ocean folds over on itself, thundering and groaning. Laird's wave, caught in 2000 and dubbed the Millennium Wave, was a massive thing, a behemoth that sucked off the reef and stacked up, blocking out the sun, thicker than his neck, than a whole redwood forest, heavier than Andre the Giant. He got towed in, thighs flexing underneath the curtain smack dab in the heat of the wave. It was the perfect image for the time. Digital media was just starting to pop, and the image showcased a new side of surfing on clunky surf websites the world over. The video was released online a few weeks later and almost broke the old surf movie VHS DVD model overnight. But back to Kelly Slater. Always back to Kelly Slater. He was so good, so handsome, so photogenic, so comfortable in the spotlight, so hungry for it that even without the Roxy movement or Laird's Ubermensch deal, he could have carried surfing out of recession and into the light alone. Sean Thompson said, "No sportsman in the world anywhere has for so many years been so far ahead of his peers." Yet the massive gap between Kelly and the rest of the field almost undid him. He won 5 consecutive world titles in the mid-1990s. After his 6th in 1998, he retired. He was the best in the world. No one was even close. Time for a different challenge, maybe. Time to scale new mountains. Except, little did Kelly Slater know, his greatest challenge was just hopping onto the world tour. Andy Irons was born on Kauai to a man who lived, breathed, and ate surf, and also rice, bananas, and avocados. Phil had moved from California to the island in 1970, having caught an early iteration of G-Land surf wanderlust. He lived in a tent on the beach and lived at a subsistence level so he could surf and surf and surf until he got married and had 2 sons in rapid succession, Andy and Bruce. Divorce soon followed, and Phil moved his boys across the street from Pine Trees, one of Kauai's better waves, and the 2 boys started surfing every single day after school. Andy was destined for greatness, and everyone knew it. Kai Borg Garcia, one of the toughest locals around, told me, "I remember watching him as a little kid surfing Pine Trees. You could always see that he had it. Fucking hood rat ripper. Surfing was different for him. Wasn't mechanical. Fucking Picasso in the water. Einstein. He looked at the ocean different. He looked at the ocean different, and he also looked different. Most excellent surfers are short little things, built with a low center of gravity for balance. Of course, there are exceptions, like Laird Hamilton. But generally, surfers are shorter, cuter things. Andy Irons was not short. And he was not cute. He was proper handsome. As handsome as Kelly, even, but in a more menacing way. Eyes that burned. An aggressive kink in his movement. The kind of energy that's looking for a fight. He also had hair, and good hair. The sort of hair bequeathed to those who trade in normalcy for a life of salt water. All manner of chestnut, hazelnut, with streaks of blonde, and a jaw that made both Laird Hamilton and Hercules burn with jealousy. He did well in the junior surf events, and then smashed a talented field at Pipeline as an 18-year-old, and then he jumped on the world tour, where he struggled for a few years before starting to put it together for a 16th place finish in 2000 and a 10th place finish in 2001. Kelly Slater must have smelled a proper challenge and jumped back on tour himself in 2002, ready to send the kid with a better jaw and better hair packing. Except in 2002, Andy Irons smashed Kelly Slater, and smashed him properly. Andy won the trophy. Kelly ended up 9th, and the fire had been lit. Andy Irons and Kelly Slater battled each other, tooth and nail, for the next 5 years, and it was, officially, the most exciting 5-year stretch in competitive surfing's history. Andy won in 2003, with Kelly Slater getting 2nd. Andy won again in 2004, with Kelly falling just short, 3 titles in a row, bam! The 2 men hated each other, which gave the rivalry a feeling of genuine importance, like it really mattered. C.J. Hopgood, a wonderful boy from Florida, told me, "Andy was the first person who came along that hated Slater. He hated everything about him. And I know hate's a strong word, but he really hated Kelly." Hate is a strong word, which is exactly what made this rivalry so delicious. Andy Irons put his imprint on Hawaiian in the same way that Duke Kahanamoku, Eddie Aikau, and Sonny Garcia had. He put his imprint on surf in the same way as Mikey Dora. He put his imprint on the movable surf party like Michael Thompson. It was a great time to be a fan, and everyone had a favorite. Either Kelly Slater and his good looks and his good, clean living, which included eating chia seeds, or Andy Irons and his good looks and his rage and his cocaine. So much cocaine.